This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Rusland, today we have, where do I begin? She's been away for a very long time, but she's back now. She is a curator. She's now pretty much based in Amsterdam. She is Ong Jolien.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you back. And we have a first time on a bit of culture, but he has been on a few other BFM shows recently. He's about to embark on his PhD. He's only 23 years old. He is Chase Smith.
Yes, thank you. And, thank you for having me.
And his PhD, which is going to be relevant, is going to be on Spain and Portugal empires in Southeast Asia.
That's right. Thanks.
Yeah. So our three topics this week will be: topic number one is, hey, let's make a museum. Topic number two is, how do you create hybridization? Did I get that right?
Yeah, hybrid identities.
Hybridization would be like breeding rabbits or something for different fur colors. And finally, what is a curator?
Yeah.
So with topic number one, hey, let's make a museum. I was thinking how I'm fascinated by museums and art galleries for that matter. And I'm interested in not just the message of the artifact inside the museum, but what the museum itself says about the society that it comes from. And you, Chase, you have Malaysian family, but you're actually an American. And Jolien, you're now based in one of the great cultural capitals of the world, with some of the great museums of the world, Amsterdam.
Great is debatable.
Well, I'd like to find out. And oftentimes I've been to museums that have are more celebrating the city that they're in, or rather the nation that they come from, as opposed to the stuff that's in there. Mm-hmm. I think of the British Museum, where it's an encyclopedic museum. You go inside and there's just so much stuff. But really what it's kind of saying is not, hey, look at Shang Dynasty bronzes. Mm-hmm. It's saying, we have all this stuff. We gathered all this stuff. It's more about the greatness of Britain. So I'm kind of wondering, see, with Malaysia, on the other hand, Malaysia's never really been able to work out when it was great, to be able to celebrate that moment and to repeat that moment. So I'm wondering, if we three were suddenly given a lot of cash, or not even much cash, how would we create a museum here? What would we like to see?
All right. Well, Jolien, you're the curator.
I think I'd like to go back to how you were talking about how a museum celebrates greatness, right?
Mm.
And maybe the thing that we need to start with is to try to find out or define for ourselves what is great. Because what you were describing earlier really is colonial conquest. That was the great moment. Mm. And like in the Netherlands and the Rijksmuseum, their sort of like claim to fame, or what makes that museum great, is great 17th century art of the golden age of the Netherlands. Yeah. But who was this age golden for? A very limited group of people. And at whose expense? Of course, the community, the people, countries that were colonized. And so for Malaysia, that, we were never a colonial power, but of course the Malay empires had a lot of power struggle as well, and their power asymmetries there. So then maybe we want to look at, what is great?
So you would go down that route. I mean, Chase, you're a fellow who actually studies at least one of the European empires that came here and very much disrupted things, the Portuguese.
Mm-hmm. Yes, no, I definitely agree with you, Jolien. I think these museums sometimes portray the country's history in a way which is almost glorifying the country's narrative. And I think this is very clear in the Rijksmuseum.
And it's glorifying the colonial conquest narrative till today.
Exactly. And I think the Dutch Golden Age, for example, the idea of, oh, look at all this beautiful art, look at all this culture, masks the kind of violence, the slavery, the other elements of this so-called golden age that wasn't necessarily golden for everyone.
Yeah.
And I think it's good how you're questioning this idea of the word great as well, because I think it's important to think about what we end up putting in museums.
Yeah.
So you mentioned the Rijksmuseum. There's all these really beautiful 17th century works of art and a lot of other periods as well. But things that survive from history that are not necessarily aesthetically pleasing, like broken pottery, for example, are just as important, but maybe don't end up in these great state museums in quite the same way. So by focusing on the beautiful and the big and the flashy, even in a national museum, maybe we're missing out part of that narrative.
I think it's like maybe it's nice to then look at a history from below as opposed to just this history of like the great things from like top down.
But if let's say in Malaysia would be one of the endpoints, one of the objects, one of the victims of some of these imperial moments. But if Malaysia were, or any Philippines, Jakarta, to create something which was just looking at the colonial moment, wouldn't that just end up being just like sour grapes?
Potentially, but I don't think all the museums in Malaysia do that at all. So, for example, the Islamic Arts Museum is a really good example, in my opinion, where it's kind of crafting this alternative narrative, this way of saying, maybe looking beyond the nation state in a way to craft an alternative geography, an alternative way of looking at the world through Islamic art. So there's, of course, the Southeast Asian art exhibit, but then there's also Islamic art from around the world. So perhaps museums also have the power to create an alternative narrative.
But it's not just, I mean, relooking the colonial period doesn't necessarily mean just recasting yourself in the position of the victim. Then it's also trying to look for things. I think this is what Chase is right. It's like outside of the scope of what is a nation state, look for other narratives where of how we contributed to things at that time, but maybe we weren't credited or things were looked at differently, or how our culture, most of what we now know today is written by, let's say, like in Malacca, a lot of it is Dutch references. So let's find out, like, for ourselves or from different sources, maybe more oral history sources, you know, what was the deal?
Okay. Can I end with this, with one quick question to the both of you, which is using your imagination. Chase, you just mentioned broken pottery. Broken pottery is actually very useful and very important for archaeological dating, and even tiniest bits of pottery sometimes are the only pieces of the story, the jigsaw, that you have, and then historians and archaeologists can piece together something from that. But just a single broken piece of pottery put on a plinth in a museum is dull. Could you imagine a way of presenting that in such a way that it actually is inspiring, captivating, tells a story? Anyone got any ideas?
I've got two.
Oh, great.
there are a lot of contemporary artists today that deal with these historical artifacts or archival documents, and they're able to do something really interesting with it. And not just, you know, what you're looking at is not just a piece of broken pottery. I like how, for example, Simran Gill works with these kinds of topics. So that's one way of doing it, looking at how contemporary artists are making new forms from these fragments of historical documents and materials. And the second thing is to try and speculate a different future from what we know from the past. So looking at the past to find a different future. And maybe this might take looking at history from, let's say, the perspective of a mushroom or the perspective of an animal. Speculative fiction.
But that's really interesting. I totally agree with you. And I think the other thing I would say is digitization. Not necessarily in a gimmicky way, because even sometimes the best intentioned museums sometimes have digitization as perhaps an aid to understanding a given piece, but it doesn't necessarily explicate it further. But I mean digitization of archives, digitization of manuscripts and objects and taking photos of things, because I think in this way we can expand out of the traditional four walls of the physical museum and really get people who have really anywhere in the world who have an internet connection to be able to interact with these pieces. And I think there's all sorts of projects, really exciting projects around the world that are trying to expand the reach of history in this way. And I think, of course, people in this you could say of my generation, this millennials generation, are more digitally native as well. So perhaps that would attract them to history in that way.
Excellent. Correct, both of you. It was a test, and you got it right. Well done. Well done. Okay, we're going to move on now to topic number two. And while you were talking, Chase, I was trying to remind myself, are we talking about hybridization, hybridity?
All right. So my question to the both of you, is how do you think hybrid or kind of mixed identities form? So I mean, so I guess we can go about this from a historical perspective to go with the theme, or we could go on it, go at it from kind of a modern perspective with our own lives. So personally, in my own life, so my father's American, he's of kind of European ancestry, as you could say, and my mother is Malaysian of Chinese ancestry. So I grew up in the States, and I only came back to Malaysia a few times in my life. And this is, I'm very lucky to spend time here now. So for me, I kind of felt in some ways like I was either dislocated from both cultural worlds, or maybe more the Asian side of my identity, and I needed to work harder to reconnect with that. So I'd like to ask you, how have you dealt with these questions of identity in your own life, and do you feel in some ways there's an element of mixture to how you define yourself?
For me, this was much more recent sort of thing that I've dealt with, because I don't have mixed parentage. I mean, I grew up my whole life here in Malaysia. Both my parents are Malaysian Chinese, even though there's probably some Thai somewhere there. But yeah, the cultural upbringing is Malaysian Chinese. And then 2.5 years ago, I moved to the Netherlands, where I now, and then I think the first year I called myself, in my bio, the first line would be, Jolene Ong is an Amsterdam-based, is a curator based between Amsterdam and Kuala Lumpur. And then fast forward to another year later, I was like, no, I can't pull that off anymore. It's just now she's from Kuala Lumpur, but currently based in Amsterdam. And then I think it'll continue to shift. So home is always never here nor there. It's always in two places at once. And I think this is what a lot of migrants and immigrants feel, and I am one in a way now. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, a kind of more privileged one. I mean, broke, but privileged. Wow. Nonetheless.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, well, and I think this, for me, I'm going to break with format here and going to add a recommendation right now, is Trinity Minha's book, Elsewhere Within Here, which I then borrowed, is the title of the exhibition I recently curated in Amsterdam, and which I added an S because everything's plural, like hybrid, and I called it Elsewhere Within Here.
Cool. I think you raise a good point, though, in that we don't even have to, you know, break things down to, I don't know what you would call it, race or mixed parentage, but sometimes our identities go through different phases in our lives, and we can change the type of person we are based on where we live, based on who we're interacting with, even the job we're doing, I think. Yeah.
Well, I'm Malay through and through, you know, Bumi, son of the soil. So I don't know what you're talking about. this hybrid stuff is coming. But if, let's say, I could imagine being, third culture, as a third culture senior, Chase. Can I speak in a patronizing tone? I don't know. It's it depends which end of the where you are set geographically at any given moment. I mean, as Jolene was saying, I mean, you know, after a while you sort of change your narrative, because your narrative changes over time.
I think what I was trying to I didn't get to say was that even though where I'm based has changed, but how I feel or where I think of as home is always these two places, even though I can't quite make that claim because I'm not physically here in Kuala Lumpur very much at all in the past, like, 2.5 years. But it is still home. And I think it'll remain the same even if I'm away for, like, let's say, already 5 or 10 years.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, that's an unchangeable dot on your history that you were born here. And you lived here for a lot of years. Your present location is Amsterdam, but we do not know if that is your dedicated, unchangeable, immutable future.
But we can make a claim. I think that's the nice part about what Chase was saying. We can change.
Well, that's the thing,
as opposed to have people decide it for us.
Yes, but then it's about you opening your heart to say, I wish to make this claim.
Mm-hmm.
You mean you could be in Amsterdam and say, I'm just here for, like, to do work for a year or so, then I'm gone. You wouldn't then say any kind of claim to that place.
I think your use of the word claim is really interesting, Cam, because ultimately a lot of identity is how we present ourselves to others. There's an element of how others see us, but then I think ultimately it's the choices we make. So, for example, I suppose here I might seem much more American, and maybe I present as more American. But then when I'm home, people hear my accent, which is a bit weird from having studied in the UK for a bit. I'm sorry for listeners who have to deal with it. But it's in America, I kind of come across in a different way. So I think I think things aren't permanent. They are ever changing and very fluid. And we are different people through our lives. And maybe we're even, perhaps we have different identities within us at any given moment.
And I think what is hybrid also changes to depending on who's looking. Because when I'm in Netherlands and I have to sort of like introduce myself, and then I notice how freaking hybrid it already is. Because they're like, wait, so you're Malay, you're from Malaysia. Well, I can say that, but nobody would buy it or let me have that claim. And then I'm like, I'm Malaysian Chinese. And then, you know, you got to explain that the migration wave was from like the Minnan speaking region and why I don't speak Mandarin, but I can speak Hokkien and Cantonese.
You do a lot of explaining, don't you?
Yeah, but you see, so I already am hybrid, even if I didn't move to the Netherlands.
Language is right. Sorry.
Yeah, well, I'd say that I think that you set the narrative later. I think you only get to sort of know it later. And a historical thing, I've always been fascinated by the what happened to Britain when Rome left in 410 AD. And so you had one culture, a kind of Romanized culture, and then a complete disappearance. And then later date, you had this thing called Anglo-Saxon culture. So I've always been wondering what happened in between. And recent work seems to suggest that there was this notion that these people, these Anglo-Saxons, came from Germany and killed everybody, and then they claimed the land. But actually, as time went by, people lived together. There were people from Germany and there were people from the native Britons. They lived together and et cetera. It was later, it was 300 years later, that they then started to say, oh, back then, 300 years ago, we became a thing called Anglo-Saxon. But those people back then, 300 years ago, had no sense of themselves as being Anglo-Saxon. Mm. And I just wonder if the narrative is set later when you sort of get a clearer idea of what your story has been.
Well, identity always has to be based on memory, especially group identity, I think. I mean, from a personal level, of course, you are who you are because of your experiences and your memories and your background and your ancestry. And then when you magnify that to the size of a community, it's this idea of you have to create an imagined past together. And while sometimes this is grounded in perhaps living together, sometimes in the case that you're describing, it's perhaps a bit more complicated.
Chase, you're a bright guy. You're working out.
But just, I have a tangential thought that sort of goes back to colonial history and what you were talking about earlier about identity, and is that I'm trying to do this thing in a research on the Stedelijk Museum, Amsterdam, and I'm trying to make the claim that Dutch culture is a hybrid culture because of the culture that they have today is a mix of like Surinamese culture from Indonesian culture. And, you know, even Indonesian itself is not a big monolithic mass, right? There are a couple of things, cultures contributing there. And then this then affects how you sort of frame a state museum. Mm. If you sort of understand like what is Dutch culture differently and absorb and are open to all these other hybrid things coming in.
Mm. And I think open is the key concept there, because whether or not these things are true, you can always, there's a sense in which sometimes these, you know, dominant narratives silence the inconvenient identities or violent histories that led to their creation. I think potentially another example would be Spain, in that the country that we see as Spain today, we see it as quite unitary. But even a brief look through the news, you will see complicated things happening in Catalonia and Barcelona. And there's, of course, the complicated history of the Basque country. Region, And even if you go way further back, the idea of Castile as a kind of dominant kingdom emerging at the end of the medieval period into the early modern period came at, potentially, you could argue, the expense of some of the other kingdoms of the Iberian Peninsula that we today call Spain.
Yep.
So I think these, back to the national narratives we were discussing, I think national narratives, as much as they positively identify things, sometimes they silence things or dampen the voices of people who are perhaps unable to speak up for themselves.
Well, speaking of dominant cultures, I wish to silence things now. And, you know,
silence the lowly intern camp, for sure.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, but also as me, I represent dominant culture here. Thank you. So we move on. But yeah, Chase, you're working out. Don't worry. Did I say that patronizingly enough? But in a moment, we're going to be asking the question that we've never actually asked here on A Bit of Culture. What is a curator here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9? And we're back with myself, Cam Ruslan, Chase Smith, and Ong Jolene. So, Jolene, yes. I introduced you earlier as a curator, mm-hmm. and you're based now in Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. What is a curator?
I think that's a nice follow-up to Let's Make a Museum. But what is a curator? I hate categories, but to sort of explain, I am an independent curator. So that usually means I'm jobless. Freelancing and jobless. Well, no, not really, but yeah. And then there are institutional curators. So those would be the curators that work in the museums you talked about. And their purview or their job description would be quite different from mine, largely because in an institution, usually there's a collection. Of course, there are also now art galleries that are sort of like a Kunsthalle format, like Ilham Gallery, that don't have a collection, but a curator there, then their job would still be quite different from mine.
Well, can I ask you something different? If, let's say, I suddenly found myself saying, oh my God, I need a curator now.
Call me.
I call Ong Jolene. Why would I be wanting to call Ong Jolene? What am I doing? Do I have an idea what I want to present? Okay, do I have a space?
Yeah.
Is that what I have first?
No. Well, okay. And then the other thing, okay, so independent curator, and largely I deal with contemporary art, visual art world. So that would be very different if you need to do a piece of pottery and find out what to do with it. Don't look for me. I don't know nothing about it. Or if you have a painting by Saad Ahmad Jamal and you need to figure out who are his contemporaries and how to sort of like make an exhibition out of it, I'm not the best person to look for either. But, if the stuff that you see, let's say at Ilham Now, so art that was made a bit more recently, but also deal with things from a very conceptual approach, then you would look for people like me.
Because you were telling me earlier that you're working on something science fiction.
Yes.
So what's the process? What happened?
Well, it was also interesting that earlier you were talking, you were like, so how does it start? Do you like figure out where to hang what? And most curators get annoyed by that because they're like, oh my God, we're not hanging stuff or just doing that. I mean, no disrespect to people that hang stuff. That's another skill set on its own. But nowadays, curators don't even necessarily come with an art history degree. It's important to know your art history and have a historical perspective. But a lot of curators have degrees in literature, cultural analysis, media culture. I myself, I studied business management and then sort of like found my way through working in MAP at Publica and dealing with every different type of art exhibition there is there. And sort of that was my being able to see what contemporary culture in Malaysia is, because I saw everything that happened in MAP at Publica. There were theatre, punk shows, art exhibitions, auctions.
Right, okay, you still haven't told me.
Told me, okay, the process.
What do you do?
What do I do? Well, okay, most of the time, if I initiate something myself, then I will draft up a concept. I usually work in an exhibition making, but it's also not just limited to that. A lot of curators do things like, I've also published a book. So it's not limited to exhibition making, though that's sort of primarily what is most common and what I do a lot of. I'll sort of figure out the concept. What is this exhibition about? What is its theme? What is it trying to communicate to the audience or to the public? Who is it trying to speak with, or rather than speaking to? So like a concept, the title, and then you sort of have to figure out who are the artists and artistic practices that you want to sort of explicate these questions, or like to be posing relevant questions around the topic I figured out.
You write the story.
Yeah. I would be like the director of the film, so to speak, and then someone else is the producer, because that takes looking for money.
So do you think we have to move beyond this idea of our image of a curator who's working in a museum, hanging up artwork? You think we have to move way beyond that?
I think it already has. Mm. Yeah. Not to say beyond as in leave that behind, but to encompass other forms of curating. But it's also kind of like my anxiety. Like if you look at my laptop, the sticker is, am I a curator? Is everybody a curator?
Yeah, because that's what I'm wondering. I mean, it doesn't...
You can curate this festival of boba tea? I don't know.
Like, but it, I mean, you know, it's like, it doesn't sound... I mean...
Was that condescending?
No.
Or we were talking about identity earlier. To what extent are we all curators of our life on social media?
Yeah. My Instagram account is curated.
Yeah. Sure. Well, I you know, it's a, I mean, I could do that, couldn't I? Could I?
You could. I mean,
so what?
Well, it takes knowing the field that you work in. So I sort of found myself, I've chosen to work within contemporary art. And although I believe in sort of like democratic access, I mean, I didn't study art history. I came into contemporary art at the intersection of like a bit of social activism and art, right? And then I got hired at this job to manage a white box and a black box that is MAP and Publica. And then I made the conscious decision to sign up for a lot of curatorial workshops. So it was kind of like on-the-job training and sort of quote-unquote informal training, but or like, well, not in the university anyway. But then, because this comes down to a question of privilege, we don't even have an art history degree in Malaysia. And even if there is, or listen, now there are MAs in curating, how many of us have the privilege, of our parents allowing us to do such a degree? We'd all get stuffed into doing like my generation anyway, maybe things are changing for Chase. do business, do accounting, do engineering, do doctor.
So then presumably you have your shtick, your there's the Ong Jolene look, the vibe, the angle. Do you have?
I usually say my interest is looking at influence and transmission. So I think I totally get what Chase is talking about in terms of hybridity. It's got a lot to do with movement because I sort of see myself as Malaysian, but also culturally Chinese. And then I'm like, you know, the Dutch culture is also at the same time is Turkish, is Moroccan, it's Indonesian, it's Surinamese. But then you also have to acknowledge the violent history of how that came to be. And that's largely my interest, looking at all the other things in this one coordinate.
Chase, could you do it? Do you want to be a curator?
I actually did work in a museum for a bit in a curatorial internship. I am the eternal intern, as my friends call me. This span over a year ago now. And it is really fascinating seeing how exhibitions are put together from behind the scenes. So this of course, was an institution rather than freelance. So it was the New York Historical Society in, of course, New York City. And it was really fascinating. I got to do a bit of background research for some exhibitions, one on silhouette images, I believe, in the 19th century. And the other was on a woman artist who was French and and she came to the young United States in the early 19th century. So it was really interesting to work on these projects and think about, how are we going to present these pieces? How are the catalogs presented? What information is relevant?
Yeah.
Exactly, because if you told every story, you'd fill up the whole world, all the buildings, but you can't do that. You only have one room or one set of rooms, and you have to think about what narrative are we telling.
Yeah.
And I really enjoyed the experience. It was fascinating. I could see it as a potential route, maybe, someday down the line.
But just to really answer your question, so like I'm working on Other Futures Festival, which is a festival for non-Western science fiction, speculative fiction, and it's in multidisciplinary, so we include games, literature, films, music and performances, and also visual arts and theory. And so then the job of the curator, me and my co-curator, is to figure out what specifically within the realm of like speculative fiction are we going to focus on this year, because it happens every 2 years. And so this year we decided we're going to look at a multi-species experiment, which means we're going to try and like look at things from what if you were a plant, or what if plants ruled this world? I mean, what if basically if humans were not in the center of it all? Because we look at this world as everything to be commodified for us. And then the curator's job is to think of how do we pose these sort of questions in an engaging way? And, you know, who are the artists doing works that are relevant to this? And yeah, and then later on we have to do other sort of more rudimentary stuff, like how will the Facebook post sound like? Like, you know, there's so much information that you like shorten it to 128 characters, for example, or in which image. Yeah. I mean,
well,
it comes
cool.
down to that as well.
Well, I I can't even begin to imagine what that is going to look like. And unfortunately, I will never get to see it because it's going to be in Amsterdam, isn't it?
Oh, come
you just
over.
Have to visit then.
Yeah, okay.
I think your point, though, about non-human perspective is very important. And it's actually a big thing in history, the idea of what happens when, instead of putting humans at the center, you think about a disease, for example, in medical history, or you think about plants or plant transfers, for example, in the Columbian exchange between the New World after, of course, the arrival of Columbus in 1492. And when you start thinking about plants, animals, it might sound a bit weird at first, but then you start to realize that there's all these other elements that impact the way our histories happen. Even something as basic as the geography of a territory. Although it's important not to be deterministic as well.
And then, so it's also interesting, like, for me as a curator to try to look at these sort of older ways of thinking and historical narratives and then try to sort of merge or find, like, intersections with, say, something newer, like new materialism and post-humanist theory that sort of, like, I think both are talking about the same thing but from slightly different angles.
It sounds like you need to hire me and Chase. That's what you're saying, isn't it?
No, I think it's the other way around, surely. I do have one question for you, actually. You mentioned before the non-Western subject of the material. So my question is, how far do you think the museum is a Western thing? Do you want to work within that structure, or do you think we have to break out of it?
And you're going to have to answer it really fast.
Okay. I'm going to use the word that Cam was using a lot, that we can make a claim onto this structure. And today, places like Southeast Asia, we are going through a moment of institutional building. So we can take whatever the basis of this idea of a museum is and make it fit us and also the time of crisis we live in today, this ecological crisis. So not just in terms of, like, geographical, sociopolitical issues, but, yeah, this wider view.
Okay, cool. Again, correct.
I'm hired. I'm the new intern now.
Yeah.
Join the bigger picture with me.
All right. So we're now going to move on to the last part of the show, recommendations, where I recommend something that we think might be of interest. I'm going to go first. My recommendation is a documentary. It's on Netflix. And I think it's connected with kind of what we've been talking about. It's called Les Bleus, or The Blues. It's about the French national football team. And how their journey from 1998 until, just 2 years ago, 2018, how it has reflected and been part of the journey of the nation's politics and cultural life. And so it's not just about, it's even barely about football, actually. It's really politics and culture. But the documentary does meet with a great many of the footballers from that time, but also historians, novelists, all French, politicians, rappers, artists, comedians, etc. And so it's really about football and culture coming together, using football as a vehicle for understanding culture. So it's called Les Bleus, and I think it'd be great to do something like that, but about, I don't know, Malaysian football or Malaysian badminton or something like that to understand this place better. So that's mine. Chase.
Yeah, that sounds really fascinating. So for mine, so on the theme of hybrid identities, so this is a translated text into English. It was one that I used a lot for my master's and of a figure I find really fascinating. And I talked about in night school at BFM as well, Manuel Godinho de Heredia. So the book is called, in English, Heredia's Description of Malacca by J.V. Mills. So the text was originally written in 1613, and I believe it was published in, don't quote me on this, but I believe the 1930s. But in any case, it was reprinted in the 90s and I believe in 2012. So it should be freely, relatively available in Malaysia. So the reason I think this text is really interesting for anyone interested in these mixed identities, the text was written by a mestiço, which is a Portuguese word, or it's also in Spanish, meaning someone of mixed lineage or heritage. So Heredia was born in the late, in around 1560, and he died around 1620. He was half Portuguese and half Malay. And this text demonstrates his fluency in these cultural worlds, in this Portuguese, he was Jesuit educated, this Western knowledge tradition world on one side, and also these myths and legends and oral traditions and even written traditions of the Malay world on the other side. So I think if you're interested in exploring cultural encounter, this is a really good English text, great place to start and kind of to look into these themes.
Wow.
I need to read that.
And you just dropped that at the end. What? I mean, okay, sorry.
Sorry.
What are the names again? I didn't catch the names at all.
Sorry, so the name of the book is Aredia's Description of Malacca by J.V. Mills. And if you're interested in Malaysian history or Malayan history, it's also very relevant as well.
Cool.
Yes.
Which era of Malacca does it talk about?
Yeah, so early 17th century, which is good because it's a very interesting text that doesn't quite fit into Portuguese or Malay categories. Mm-hmm. So it's a very valuable text of that period.
And does it talk about daily life or is it, you know, just facts and figures? Or
It's a bit of both, yeah. So it's what historians or other scholars might call a historical geographical treatise. So it provides, in the Renaissance, they didn't necessarily have these firm divisions of knowledge like we do now in quite the same way. So he incorporates a lot of what we would term different subjects. Like he puts pictures of plants, so botany, he writes history of the kings of Malacca, he provides maps and cartography, so what we might call geography. So it's a really rich text that goes across quite a lot of what are modern disciplines today.
Wow, cool. Okay. I'm going to look it up. And Jolene, beat that. I think you can.
I won't beat that, but I can lighten it up. My recommendation has to do with my own name because I'm a Leo and it's all about me. My recommendation is a podcast. So this one, everyone can access no matter where you are. It's Dolly Parton's America.
Cool.
Not by Dolly Parton, but by Jad Abumrad. So it's someone trying to understand America through Dolly Parton's songs and also Dolly Parton, this figure, this sort of really popular figure that the world, everyone knows. And I think it's kind of interesting in terms of, like, as a curator, I find this sort of perspective really interesting because it's looking at something that we assume we know everything about, or we're always confronted with its image. We think we're not interested because you're like, oh, this is not my thing, right? Because you take a look at the surface. But then this podcast sort of like really digs deeper. It puts down, I mean, it goes in without any preconceptions, and then you're able to see something else. And I think that's really important if you're working in the curatorial field.
So what's it called again?
Dolly Parton's America. That's easy enough to remember.
Okay, and I'm going to get into discussions with producer Daryl, see if we can play out with a Dolly Parton song.
Not Jolene, please.
All right, well, you choose one then. You choose one, Jolene. So don't have to choose it now. Speak later. And so only remains me now to thank special guests who we've flown in all the way from Amsterdam. she's staying now in the penthouse suite in Manara, a bit of culture.
Lovely to be back in the penthouse, always.
Ong Jolene, well, great to have you.
Thank you.
And also, we may well hear from him again. I'm not sure what his tenure is.
Hopefully.
Chase Smith and... myself, Cam Rastlan, and thank you for joining us. And please join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture as we play out with some Dolly Parton here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.